Hi, and welcome to the Man Down podcast, the podcast where we talk all things men's mental health, masculinity, vulnerability, and everything in between. From guest interviews with inspirational individuals sharing their own vulnerabilities, through to the breakdown, where we break down different types of mental health support so that you can make the most educated and best informed decision possible to get help for yourself. As Matt Haig says, man up is not a call to strength, it's a demand of weakness. And the time for man up is over. This is Man Down. I am incredibly proud to say that Man Down is brought to you in partnership with Better, a charity raising awareness around mental health and suicide prevention through a range of exciting events and initiatives. Please head over to www.better.org.uk, that's B-E-D-E-R, or find them on Instagram at better_UK. Hello and welcome to episode 52 of the Man Down podcast with Dr. Russell Kennedy. I'm speaking with Dr. Russ about all things anxiety, trauma, healing, somatic therapies, breath work, of course, and even plant medicine and psychedelics. Dr. Russ is an incredible thought leader in the space of how we can heal and treat anxiety. With a background in medicine, neuroscience, developmental psychology, yoga, meditation, and somatics, I can't think of anybody better to speak to on this topic. And I hope you enjoy the episode. So, Dr. Russ, how are you?
Thank you for joining me. I think I'm overwhelmed but equipped. I think that's probably the words that I would use right now. My mom broke her hip about 10 days ago. And actually, it must be about 2 weeks ago now because I spent 6 nights at her place. And if you think you're like Ram Dass says, if you think you're enlightened, go live with your parents for a while. So I did that. And so there's that. I'm finishing the audiobook and I'm producing it myself, which is probably a stupid idea, but I like having creative control over stuff. So, and it's just so complex, but it's easy. Like the steps are easy, but they have to be done in this order. And so that's on my mind. We're getting a new puppy. We're supposed to get her in a month, but I guess the breeder says we have to take her early. And I'm doing a training this weekend. So I'm taking the training, I'm not giving it. So there's a lot of things going on, but your breath works definitely help. Just getting into the body and just realizing that all this shit that your mind comes up with is just trying to make sense out of the alarm feeling in your body. And if you can treat the alarm feeling in your body directly by getting into your parasympathetic nervous system with things like breath work and movement and that kind of stuff, that's 90% of the battle is just getting out of your head, So that's how I'm doing. There's a rather long, I could have just said, fine, I'm doing good.
Yeah, no, I'm all about, especially on this podcast, proper answers to that question. So thank you for going with it. And there's some bits in there already that I definitely want to dive into around this notion of alarm. But before we dive into the good stuff, that I know we will, would you mind just sort of giving a brief introduction to yourself for anybody who hasn't come across you before?
Sure. My name is Russell Kennedy. I am a medical doctor, a neuroscientist, and developmental psychology nerd, I guess. I grew up with a father with schizophrenia and bipolar. So my house was in chaos a lot. He was never violent or abusive, but it's just, he would get into these psychotic depressions or these manic phases where he was up for 3 or 4 days at a time. And he, for some reason, took a shine to the trumpet, which is the worst instrument you can possibly play in a house because you can't play it melodically or, calmly. It always has to be like an assault. So I grew up watching him decline, actually, until he finally committed suicide when I was about 26. He was 52. And I just had this petrified fear that I was going to turn out like him, so I think that considerably, and I was already a very sensitive kid, like when I was really little, when I was 3 or 4 or 5, I would still cry when I was hurt. So that didn't go down well with the other kids very well. So I've always had this sort of sensitive nature. And then on top of that, having a father who was really significantly mentally ill just kind of tripped me right into anxiety. And some people with childhood wounding like that, they'll go into OCD. Some people go into eating disorders. Some people get depressed. You know, anxiety was kind of my, you know, soup du jour as far as that kind of went. So I devoted my life to really helping other people with anxiety so they don't have to suffer with it like I did. And I have a lot of counterintuitive approaches. I don't believe a lot in the psychology, psychiatry model. I think it's outdated. I don't think it works. I think we're seeing things now like the psychedelics that are really exciting because they're really getting bypassing that ego and allowing you to sort of bypass that overprotection. So I think it's just, I think things, times are changing. I think it really is important to understand that I can be a practitioner of medicine and practice medicine, but still do it in a way that you know, really focuses on the body and the body's role in mental illness and healing in general, which I think in our society, we don't pay attention to. We think that everything can be healed by the mind. We have this fixation on the mind and we glorify the mind and we worship the mind when really a lot of the healing comes from the body.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I was listening to an interview with Dan Brulé, who's like one of the old masters of breathwork. Yeah. And he was talking about the role of obviously the vagus nerve, which you and I will be very familiar with, yeah. But for anybody not listening, is, you know, the longest nerve in the human body, and also governs that stress response, that fluctuation between fight, flight, rest and digest. And he made the point that studies have found that 80% of the signals in the vagus nerve actually go from the body to the brain, yeah, rather than from the brain to the body.
Yeah.
So that is fascinating, I think, as you said, in terms of the role that the body plays within, you know, anxiety and, you know, the term that you use right at the top, alarm. So, yeah, you know, with the new book, obviously Anxiety RX, that's been out, how long has it been out now for?
I think about 8 or 9 months now, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. So there it is. So with the new book, obviously the focus of this is looking at a new approach to how we work with anxiety, and within that, for people listening who might be familiar with their own experience of anxiety, what, from your approach, what is anxiety? What are we actually talking about?
Yeah, well, for my approach, anxiety is merely the thought, anxious thoughts of the mind, the worried future-based thoughts of the mind. That's in my approach. Anxiety is not painful itself. It's the alarm that we hold in our body from unresolved trauma. That's painful. But the anxious thoughts aren't painful at all until you believe them. Because I tell a little story about, if I have two teenagers in my office, a boy and a girl, and they're 15 years old, and I go, Jessica, I think you might be pregnant, she'll freak out. You know, her body will go into fight or flight. She'll secrete cortisol, epinephrine, all that kind of stuff. And if I go into the other room and I say, hey, Jeff, I think you might be pregnant, he'll just laugh and his body won't react to it at all. So it just shows you the power of belief. It's not the thought specifically. It's the fact that we consciously and unconsciously believe that thought. And when we do that, it's the change in our body. You know, that's really what creates a lot of it. And then once you get that negative change in your body, you go into alarm, you lose your rational part of your brain, you lose your prefrontal cortex. So you go into survival brain. And in survival brain, you have no real or limited rational capability. So will you, these worries come up that you made up yourself, and then you believe them because the rational part of your brain has gone offline. So if you were in your right mind, you go, unlikely that's going to happen. But when you're in survival brain, when all your cortisol and epinephrine's running around in your system, these worries seem real. They seem actually like they're going to happen. So, you know, it really is one of those situations where we have to understand where the true genesis of anxiety comes from, which in my opinion comes from old, unresolved, you know, wounds in childhood, typically from some attachment issues. You know, like parents weren't there for you in a way, you had to grow up too early, you had abuse, abandonment, loss, neglect, whatever it was, and you never really got that sense of security in your body. And that hypervigilance in your body turns into hypervigilance in your mind. And because the brain has a natural fear bias, just everything just cycles out of control. So you start creating fearful stories about the fearful feeling that's in your body. And then everything just starts to cycle out of control. So it's just so important to deal with the body. And I have nothing against CBT. I have nothing against psychotherapy. I have nothing against talk therapy. I do have something, however, against those things alone, because I don't think purely talking about it, purely doing something on a cognitive level really gets into those implicit body memories that motivate our alarm, that motivate our fearful thoughts. So unless we actually get in the same room with the motivation of these things, we don't really change it that much.
Yeah. And I guess that leads quite nicely onto something that I've grappled with myself in my own, with my own anxiety, is when I first started having therapy, CBT specifically, I was sort of, I suppose to an extent, appeased temporarily by this idea that knowledge was power, in the sense that, like, okay, I know what my triggers are, that feels better, but actually things were still coming up. So in terms of that piece of the puzzle, like, what role do you think actually having an understanding plays within that healing process?
Yeah, I mean, Dr. Dan Siegel, who is at heads the MindSight Institute in California, you know, he talks about having a coherent narrative of your life. So I think it is important to know, and timeline therapy is really important in that sort of thing too. I think it's really important to have some sort of coherent knowledge of what happened to you and the structure of your life and how that's affected your life. I don't think, though, that cognitive behavior therapy really makes a big dent in anxiety long-term. In short term, it's been definitely shown, it's sort of evidence-based to show that it really does help. And I think modifying your thoughts does help. It really makes a difference. But the problem is your body will always drag you back down to that previous place, you know? So when things are going good and you're practicing mindfulness and cognitive therapy and all that, then things are fine. But if things don't go so well and your body starts getting reactive, you start going into survival body, survival brain, survival physiology, then you're more likely to fall back into your old grooves again. And the main issue I have with a lot of cognitive therapies is if the cognitive part of your brain goes offline when you get stressed, why are you trying to use a cognitive therapy? Because you don't actually have the brain power to use these things that they've taught you. So that's my big issue with the cognitive therapies, is they tend to fail you when you need them the most, right? So that's the thing. So, and I'm not saying, I'm saying it is important to have a narrative of your life to understand what happened. But I think we focus so much on believing that just thinking, just this new insight is going to really help me understand and help me heal from anxiety. And insights, you know, insights are the popcorn of psychotherapy. Like, they're just, they help, but they're not going to heal you.
Yeah, I think it's very much a starting point, speaking from experience. And actually what I found, so you mentioned attachment theory and attachment styles and all of that stemming from issues in childhood. And a lot of my anxiety and panic attacks came up and come up to a much lesser extent now within romantic relationships. And what I found in my most recent relationship was this stuff was starting to come up as strongly as it ever had, because it was a serious relationship, you know, cared deeply about this person. And what I actually found was, because I knew, I had the insight, I had the understanding of what was going on, but because I couldn't stop it, because I couldn't rationalize my way out of it, I actually resented myself more, because I was frustrated because I couldn't think, I couldn't get, I was like, but I know where this is coming from. This is a pattern. This is a trauma, blah, blah, blah. And I actually ended up getting more frustrated, and I was doubling down because I was then annoyed and frustrated at myself for still having that reaction. So yeah, it was a fun ride.
Which locks you in it, Jamie. That's the thing. Like, Brene Brown talks about that too. Like, anything you judge, abandon, blame, and shame yourself about, you'll continue. It will just continue. Mm. You lock yourself in it, right? So if that was me and I was sort of counseling you, I'd say, can you find the little boy in you who did feel abandoned, who couldn't trust love as much as he wanted to, and now realizes that he's face to face with this old trauma of not trusting love, and he's going into this place with someone he really feels connected to. There's something called defensive detachment that Dr. Gordon Neufeld coined this term. He's a developmental psychologist over in Vancouver. which means that if love wasn't safe for you as a child, for me, like loving my dad eventually just didn't turn out to be not, it turned out not to be safe for me. I mean, he was ever abusive or violent, but you know, he was kind of my protector, and, you know, he taught me how to fish and, you know, play all this stuff. And then I would see him go crazy. So for me, I just learned over time after this would happen over and over and over again, that it wasn't safe to love him. So love wasn't safe is basically the unconscious message that I got. So when I got into romantic relationships, as I got older, and I've been divorced twice, so, you know, I can speak from experience here, is that when I would get too close to someone, that defensive detachment would come in. And I think that's a lot of what people call avoidance, you know, like avoidant detachment, is because when they were younger, love wasn't safe. Love really wasn't trustable. And I always say, love is always trustable. People may not be, but love always is. So it's learning, like, okay, I'm going into defensive detachment. Appreciate that yourself. You know, like, I realize that you're trying to protect me with this. I understand that that's what it's about. You know, where are you? Like, try and find the place in your body that resists the connection, because chances are that's probably a younger version of yourself that was hurt. And if you can connect with that younger version, you actually treat the problem at its source, as opposed to just trying to cognitively talk yourself into why you shouldn't be doing this, which only actually keeps you locked in that same pattern of behavior.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I am very interested, you know, as a result of my own battles around attachment styles and attachment theory. And one sort of light bulb moment for me in the last year or so was, you know, I've always been, I suppose, what you would deem more anxiously attached. And the way my like severe anxiety would come up would be to really, you know, run towards, cling on, hold on for dear life, which, you know, plays out in ultimately pushing someone away. Yeah. But also that defensive detachment, that avoidance, if as people term it, you know, it's actually coming from the same fear. It's just playing out in different ways, which I think is super, super interesting. So in terms of, I suppose, working, you know, we talked about working with the body and these new ways to approach anxiety. What does that look like? You touched on a little bit there around how we identify it, how we go looking for it, looking at it as this alarm. But what is the process if you're working with someone one-to-one? What does that look like?
Yeah, I mean, I have my own little sort of intuitive way of working with people. If you've heard me on Clubhouse, you know that I kind of see things in people's past. I don't really know where it comes from, but I can kind of see where they have issues. And usually what I'll do is I'll get them to bring up a trauma from their past, not their worst trauma, but a trauma that bothers them. And then just get really quiet and then focus on your body and just see where that lights up, you know. And often I'll say, you know, look in your chest, look between your chin and your pubic bone. And it's usually in the midline somewhere, but it kind of feels like a heartache. It kind of feels like a breakup, or, you know, when a pet dies, or you know, there's a trauma in your life. Like, try and localize that area in your body. And some people will describe it as a pressure, a pain, a temperature. It's dense, you know. So I try and get people to describe their alarm as much as they can, because I do feel a lot of that alarm is their younger self. And that alarm is basically the younger self's way of trying to get your attention to say, hey, connect with me, love me, because this is an old wound that's being stirred up. And typically what we do when we're not aware of this is that we will distract, you know, we'll find another way of, you know, moving away. And I usually sort of say to people, like, if you had a child come up to you who's like tearful and crying and holding their hands up to be picked up, would you just sort of turn away and go to the internet, or, you know, go shopping, or like, you wouldn't do that. But we do that all the time to the younger version of ourself that's asking via this alarm for our attention. And once you learn where it is, and you kind of put your hand over it and maybe do some movement around it, like some circles or whatever. And I realize, you know, when I'm a medical doctor, so when I say this, I want to have a seizure, because it's just so antithetical to the way I was trained as a physician. But it really does come down to finding that emotion, what I call the emotional signature of pain and trauma and alarm in you, and really realizing that that probably is your younger self. It's probably, you know, a version of you who went through trauma and is still part of you, is still at that age, you know, 6, 8, 12 years old. So it's talk to them like a 6, 8, or 12-year-old and just try and connect with them and just say, you know, for as long as we're on this earth together, I'm going to look after you. I know you think that I probably abandoned you, and in a way, I didn't know you were there. But now that I know you're there, now that I found my alarm and I found where you are, I'm going to do my damnedest to make sure that you're taken care of. And this takes a while. Like it, you know, if we've ignored our child, our younger self, or whatever you want to call it, for a long time, they stop trusting us. And it takes a while for them to sort of regain our trust, in the same way it takes us a while to regain the trust of someone that we love, but we don't know if they're going to hurt us or not.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. I think I've definitely found this, you know, the work that I do with breath work is occasionally coming from a much more traditional background, sort of hearing myself and thinking, oh, I'm not sure, like 3, 4, 5 years ago, would I have listened to me?
Right.
And I think probably the answer is no. And I'd love to know, kind of in that meeting of worlds for you, I guess, in terms of your work as a, you know, an MD and neuroscientist, and I suppose more, I don't know if traditional is the right word, but more
scientifically trained kind of thing.
Yeah. Like where does that meeting of worlds sit for you, and how do you find it actually gives you, I suppose, an element of credibility in the work that you're now doing to be able to say, you know, I've seen both sides and this is where I've come out.
Yeah, I think that's your last sentence was very poignant. I think that's true. And it's amazing how scientific emotion and spirit can be. You know, they're not that separate. And I think that that's one of the fallacies that we run with. You know, when people hear, you know, someone talk about inner child or younger self, I try and avoid those things because they're really emotionally, you know, charged, and people go, oh, it's a bunch of bollocks, you know, it's whatever. And but I do back it up, you know, like as from all the stuff that I've learned through my training, especially mostly just dealing with people. Like I've had over 100,000 patient encounters in my career. Like not all of them were for mental disorders, of course, but there's usually some sort of mental disorder behind or mental issue behind any illness. So, you know, just being able to read people and understand where they're coming from and just sort of giving them an alternate. And for most people, when I tell them, like I get messages every day saying, you know, that thing where about considering that anxiety is more of an alarm situation in your body than a thinking of your mind has made an immeasurable difference in my life, because I finally had this felt sense of really where it's coming from, as opposed to just sort of, you know, I should think better. I should think more positively. I should just be, you know, I should be thinking better. And if I'm thinking better, I'm feeling better. Cause it's, you know, the secret, there's all this stuff out there about, you know, how your thoughts change your mind or change your body. And, you know, the thoughts changing the body is infinitely less powerful than the body changing the mind. But we're still in reductionist medicine, we're still trying to chase that elusive, well, if you think better, your body will feel better. And on some level, that's true. But again, like I said earlier, it's very hard to think in contradiction to how you feel for an extended period of time.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. And do you think that is almost human nature,
yes,
that we have started to, or have traditionally and historically almost, you know, fetishized the power of the mind?
Yeah. Well, it's done so much. I mean, if you look at, you know, putting people in orbit, you know, on the moon, putting, you know, making electric cars, you know, like the mind has done some amazingly, amazingly brilliant things. And here's another thing that I find with people who are anxious, they're usually quite smart. You know, because I think, you know, one of the things that I think about with anxiety is I think when you have trauma, when you're younger and you don't have an attachment figure around to help you metabolize it and help you work through it, it gets stored in your body, right? So you stuff it down into your body. So as we get older, we don't want to go down into our body anymore, right? Like it's just like, it's too painful down there. So what happens is we wind up staying up on our heads and creating worries and what ifs and warnings and worst case scenarios, because that keeps us out of feeling town in our body. So the worries have to get, the thoughts have to get more elaborate. And this is where OCD comes from, I believe, too, is that they have to get more and more elaborate to keep us up in our heads. The worries have to get more and more fearful to keep us up in our heads, because we don't want to go back down into our body. And as a result, a lot of people with anxiety, because they're so good at thinking, they practice it all the time, they get very good at sort of thought processes, at thinking. And they're very kind of smart in a way. But the price you pay for that is you lose touch with your body. You know, I can't tell you how many people I've talked to with anxiety that don't know when they have to go to the bathroom until it's almost upon them. They don't know when they're hungry until they're absolutely ravenous, because they've stuffed their body down for so long. They've denied their body for so long that they've lost its sensation. You know, what you were saying earlier on about 80% of the vagus nerve being afferent, meaning going from the body to the brain. And it's still not enough. Like our mind is so powerful that we can stick in our mind and that's what people break down, is that they lose their body and then they try and solve something with their mind that's not solvable with their mind. And they create so much entropy in their mind that they can't form anything that allows them to move forward in their life, because they're trapped.
Mm. Yeah, it is bit of a vicious cycle ultimately, isn't it? When you fall into that trap. I heard it talked about, sort of referring back to what we were saying earlier, is the talk therapy trap, because you just get locked in that loop. I want to come to a word that gets thrown around a lot. It's something that we've touched on as well a little bit in our conversation already, is something we see a lot talked about on social media within the mental health space at the moment, and it's trauma.
Yeah,
and I think it gets chucked around quite a lot, and I know I've been guilty of it at times. And I'd like to kind of dive into, for people listening, you know, from your professional and personal perspective, you know, what is trauma?
It's a really good question. You know, I have a very sort of easy definition of trauma. It's anything that overwhelms us. Anything that overwhelms our mind is trauma. So we're all born with a different, I believe, kind of sensitivity set point. Some people are born thick-skinned, you know, and if you're born thick-skinned in an environment where you get, you know, attachment, you're probably going to do just fine. If you're born thin-skinned in a family that gets a lot of attachment, you're still probably going to be fine. If you're born thin-skinned in an environment that's very sensitive, that's very challenging, you're probably going to get overwhelmed. You know, so I've seen, you know, I had patients who got overwhelmed. I had one patient who got overwhelmed with a death of her goldfish, and she was like 16 or 17 years old. And that was a traumatic event for her. So it's a combination of what's your underlying sensitivity and what's the depth of the trauma that you had. So I think that it's a real kind of crapshoot in there, because we never really know. You get a certain sense of your own sensitivity as you get older, if you're a highly sensitive person, or, you know, you're average. And I think it's really important to realize, if you're a really sensitive person, that you are, and you combine that with a fear bias in the brain, you know, you're probably going to head towards the negative. That's probably what's going to happen over time, especially in this environment. It's like Krishnamurti when he said, it's no measure of good health to be adjusted to a profoundly sick society. Right, so it is one of those things where I think people with anxiety or whatever, their minds are operating quote unquote normally for the level of sensitivity that they have and for the trauma that they're trying to process. So their brain is just trying to help them in the best way that it can, and the ego too, but it winds up sort of overprotecting them, so they don't. You don't challenge yourself. If you don't challenge yourself, you don't grow. Then you feel guilty, like, oh, I'm not growing, I'm not doing very good, and then it just starts this victim-based cycle that just, you know, there's so many factors to it that I put in the book that help people understand where their anxiety comes from and how it gets perpetuated. So you know, just dealing with the body, I think, is one of the ways that we can sort of break that kind of fixation that we have that the mind is going to fix us, because it's not.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, neuroscientifically, you know, what is going on when we experience trauma? What is the sort of, what is the process there?
Well, There's two main structures for memory in the brain. There's the amygdala, which is colloquially called the fear center, and then there's the hippocampus. So the way I kind of describe it is the hippocampus is kind of like the time date stamp. Like the hippocampus will sort of, if you were, got hit when you're on your, when you're 12 years old, you got hit by a car on your bike. There'll be an autobiographical part, like at this particular intersection, when I was 12 years old, I got hit by the bike or by the car. And so, but there's an emotional component that actually gets put into our body at that point too. There's a trauma that gets put in there as well. So it's trying to get both of them to connect with each other. And that's why I think Peter Levine's work, somatic experiencing, he talks personally about being in a car accident, being hit by a car, and having a very friendly person there to be able to hold his hand, to connect with him so he didn't feel so alone, and use that power of human connection and use the body to kind of regulate that thing so he won't get PTSD. Because I think what happens with PTSD is that we get these traumas, whatever you want to describe it, and they're not metabolized at all. Like there isn't a connected figure there to help you. So it gets pushed into your body. So from a neuroscience point of view, the hippocampus kind of time date stamps memories. So it gives us the image that this happened in the past, right? So if I got hit by a car on my bike when I was 12 and a car comes whipping around the corner, I'm on another bike, I'm probably going to get a jolt of like, look out, like there's trouble here. Because it is wired into us as far as that kind of stuff goes. So the hippocampus, what it will do is it'll say, hey, this happened when you were 12 years old. This happened 40 years ago. And you're kind of like, yeah, you're right. Now, if there's a trauma like an abuse, like an emotional, physical, sexual abuse, the hippocampus doesn't work very well because it gets paralyzed by adrenaline and epinephrine. So, or adrenaline and cortisol. So what happens is that when we go through these traumas, the hippocampus, which is kind of what it would tell us that, hey, this happened in the past, this isn't still happening now, gets paralyzed. Whereas the amygdala has no sense of time. So the amygdala will record it, the hippocampus will record it, but the amygdala, because it has no sense of time, when we experience something that's very similar to that trauma in our current environment, part of us will get transported back to the age we were at the time of the trauma with all the wherewithal we'd have as a 12-year-old or whatever. So it's from a neuroscience point of view, it really is how well that trauma is integrated. Dan Siegel talks about this too, about, disparate parts, say there's parts of the mind and the body that because of the trauma became disconnected. They don't flow together anymore. And then as soon as we experience something that's similar to that, like a dog bit us when we were younger and we see a dog approaching us now, these disparate parts will all light up. But because there's no flow there, it will create this paralyzing state with us. So what the hippocampus does is it starts to integrate those traumas. So when you go through things like systematic desensitization, where they would show you, pictures of dogs, and then you'd go closer to dogs and that. So you would start to know that there is a flow state that you can get into. You can be in the presence of a dog and still be okay. You can realize that this occurred in the past. It isn't still happening now. And then that helps you heal through it. And I think the same goes for trauma. It's just realizing because, when we experience abuse, loss, abandonment as kids, and we get something like that in our present day, we regress, And I like to say that if you get a major reaction from someone, any major emotional reaction is an age regression, So when you fight with your partner, it's like 2 6-year-olds duking it out. And, how do you think that's going to go? Probably not very well, and probably not very cognitively. Right. So it's realizing, I have a picture, like both Cynthia, my wife, and I have pictures of each other when we're like 6 8 years old around the house. So sometimes when she's, getting on my nerves or whatever it is, I'll go look at that picture and it's like, oh, she's just a little girl. Like just that's the part of her that's getting lit up right now. And it's just so much easier to see her with compassion when you have that framework to go by.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I had quite an unfortunate experience where I got locked out of my house recently, and I had to get an emergency. Well, I didn't have to. The decision I ended up making, because my rational brain started to go fine, right, was I was going to get an emergency locksmith out to let me in. And right, he was very good at what he did, in the sense that I got told on the phone it was going to be X amount, and then the price kept going up and up and up. And by the time it got to that point, I was in full tantrum mode. Yeah. And to the point where when he gave me the invoice, the child in me snatched it out of his hand, turned around and walked back up the stairs and sort of just left him to shut the door and show himself out. And I told my partner about this and she was like, it's kind of cute. I was like, it's not what I need to hear right now, but I agree. It's like, it is what, if once you can see it is that regression. I think it's super, super interesting. And it does help to come at it from a position of self-compassion and, you know, also compassion outside of yourself.
So Jamie, knowing that story, like, I can't resist. When you were a child, did you get locked out of something that you couldn't get back into?
It's a really good question. You know what I think it is? It's something I've seen come up in my life quite a lot. And I will go a bit further back to try and figure out where this first happened. But I seem to have a really strong emotional reaction to feeling like I'm looking stupid, feeling like I've done something. And in that situation, it was I ended up paying a lot of money when it could have been avoided.
Right.
And I'd locked myself out. So double stupid. Right. And I also felt a little bit like I'd been taken advantage of, which I think brought up stuff as well. Right. So where did that come from? God. That's a very good question.
Just something that you wanted as a child, but couldn't have access to, you know, like your parents still together?
No.
When did they split up?
When I was 15.
Okay. And which one couldn't you have access to?
My dad.
Okay. Yeah. This is what I do. Like, this is what I do. Right. Like, it's just, things come to me and it's like, okay, this is it. So, and that's what helps me work with people with anxiety, because people come in with anxiety and they don't know where it comes from. You know, they've had a bunch of traumas as children, and it's like, okay, well, that's fine. Let's find the source and then let's work on the source. Cause if you work on the ultimate source of it, it's so, you know, it just heals in this holistic kind of, you know, kind of sequential way. It's still up and down. Healing is not linear, but if you can find where the source of it is and really give yourself, you know, find that 15-year-old in you and just sort of talk to him about how difficult it was when dad moved out and you didn't have access to him and you didn't know where he was, or the next time he was going to show up, or whether or not, you know, he was going to be there for you and all that kind of stuff. It's really important to go into that in your own time, in your own self, and just really work that through with that 15-year-old.
Mm. Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. I saw a really amazing, or what I thought was a really amazing sort of definition of PTSD and of panic disorder, is that it's a negatively weighted temporal dislocation whereby your previous negative emotions are affecting you in the present.
Yeah.
So I guess it's a fancy way of saying a regression.
Basically. Yeah, time travel. Yeah, emotional time travel. That was the other thing. Yeah. I heard a really interesting thing the other day about, I think it's in Peter Levine's book, the one in 2017, An Unspoken Voice. But he talks about this person that doesn't call it PTSD at all. He calls it PTSI because it's a post-traumatic stress injury. It's not a disorder. It was something that injured him that's still with him. So I found that really interesting, not calling it PTSD, but calling it PTSI, because it is an injury. You know, it is an injury of some kind, and it may not be overt or physical. You know, it could be like, you know, like you, like your dad kind of, your mom and dad split and your dad, you know, you didn't have access to him. So that's traumatic. You know, all anxiety is separation anxiety. I'm certain of that. And it's mostly separation from yourself. And sort of, it's just finding where you separated from yourself and reconnecting with that part, as ethereal as kind of that sounds. And I think that's what breathwork does. I think breathwork, you know, are you familiar with the research on the default mode network and the ego and that kind of stuff? Really interesting stuff about how breathwork seems to paralyze the default mode network and how the ego lives in the default mode network, which is this, you know, structures in the brain, anterior cingulate, that kind of stuff. You want to get into the science of it. But It seems to, it's kind of like the daydreaming state of the brain. When you're not doing something actively, you're focused on something, what state does your brain go into? And this is found in the kind of around the 2000s, that the brain goes into this kind of, you know, it's not really resting, but it's the same kind of pattern. And people report that they get the same kind of thoughts, the same kind of rumination. So I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, when you go through a breakup or you're going through a difficult time, you can go to work and people say, I don't know how I'm getting to work because I'm just devastated emotionally. Well, it's a distraction. It takes you out of the default mode network, you know, and it takes you out of that ego. And psychedelics are now kind of showing that they're paralyzing the default mode network, and they're also paralyzing the ego. So they're wondering, you know, is the ego sitting in that old default mode network, just kind of judging, abandoning, blaming, and shaming you? And if your body's doing okay, you know, you can probably override it. But if you're having a particular time where your body isn't doing well, like it's in alarm mode, that default mode network can really be your worst enemy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I think I first came to the conversation around the default mode network and healing through psychedelic work with reading Michael Pollan. Mm-hmm. And his work and his book,
How to Change Your Mind.
How to Change Your Mind. He's got a new one coming up that I've just
pre-ordered. Good. Yeah, I didn't know that. Cool. Okay.
Your mind on plants or your brain on plants.
Okay, cool.
His next one. But yeah, How to Change Your Mind for anybody listening who's curious around that kind of psychedelic therapy work. Definitely worth checking out. And quite a nice segue, I think. I'd love to talk because I was actually listening to Michael Pollan on a podcast this morning. And his excitement, and I share his excitement, seems to be around, I suppose, the level of credibility of the people that are starting to get involved in the conversation around psychedelics. And I would, you know, include yourself in that in terms of your background. And, you know, I'd love to hear about your own experiences with psychedelics, but also then maybe chat a little bit around, you know, the work that is being done. I appreciate, you know, that's not your field per se, but also I'd love to just get your take on it.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's about this overprotective ego that we create. And I write about this in the book, is that we kind of, when we're younger, if we go through trauma, we create this overprotective dragon, this ego dragon that is omnipotent, you know, but it's got the brain of a child. Like, it's very powerful, but it's got the brain of a child, and it will avoid anything that's ever hurt you. And it will keep you away from anything that's ever hurt you. So if you sang in your class when you were, you know, 8 years old and the teacher said, oh, that's terrible singing, or someone said that, that ego dragon will make damn sure that you never sing in front of an audience ever again, right? So it is one of those things that we create this mythical figure to protect us, but it winds up overprotecting us. And I think that even in therapy, even in talk therapy, it doesn't actually allow us to get into those old implicit body memories, those old programs, core beliefs, whatever you want to call them. They don't allow us to get at that because the ego is just, there's no way we're going to talk about this. This is just too painful. And I guess what breathwork does on some level, and what the psychedelics are known to do, is just to kind of blur that line between the conscious and the unconscious, and between self and you know, and other, and self and environment. Because when I've been on psychedelics, you just feel one with everything. Like, it just feels like you're just connected to everything. There's nothing that's outside of you. There's nothing that's not you. So I think psychedelics have this ability of paralyzing that protective ego and allowing you to kind of access that child, you know, that five-year-old who was hit by his mom or whatever, and really see that it wasn't your fault. See her for the you know, the childhood she had, just to kind of get past that initial, you know, fort where nobody gets in there. Like, no one gets in there. And if you can't get in there, and, you know, talk therapy is really not that great at getting in there, you're not going to change it. You know, you're not going to, you know, if you've got a burned out light bulb in your bedroom and your bedroom's locked, not to bring up the locksmith again, but you're not going to be able to change that light bulb because you can't get into that bedroom. So I think what the ego does is it, you know, it blocks you from getting into the bedroom where the programs are. So when you take a psychedelic or you do breath work or whatever, that ego kind of has a chance to kind of leave for a while. So you see things that you normally wouldn't. Because when you're in your right mind, whatever that means, your ego is highly active and it's highly protective. So it won't let you see the traumas because it doesn't, it's a one trick pony. It's a one trick dragon. If something hurt you, never again. That's its motto. Right. So I think with breath work, I think the psychedelics, they kind of give you this thing like, why did I overreact so much? Like, why was I so worried about that? It's not actually a big a deal as I made it, because, you know, you make these things a big deal when you're a child. So I think that's where we're going, I think, with it is, and people ask me, do you recommend I do psychedelics for my anxiety or my depression? And I say, no, I actually don't. I recommend that you do 6 months of somatic experiencing therapy and breath work and connecting with your body. And then if you still need to, then I would do that. But it's kind of hitting an ant with a sledgehammer. And you know, it took me probably 2 years after ayahuasca to kind of get back to a place where I was kind of level again, because it does take you into a different world where you have no anchors, you have no boundaries. You know, you are not who you think you are, which is good and bad. So I guess, you know, getting back to the therapeutic advantages, you know, we just start, you know, getting that ego to sort of step aside a little bit so we can kind of help ourselves and see what our traumas are and maybe metabolize them and get in the door and get in that room. Otherwise, the ego will just never let you in that room.
Yeah, it's interesting. The thing that came up for me there was, I guess, people often talk about, you know, how our anxiety thinks it's protecting us.
Yeah.
And our ego always thinks it's protecting us. And, you know, that fear that can come up for people within psychedelic experiences, I suppose, is because that protection is no longer there. And you're being, you know, stared in the face by potentially some uncomfortable truths, some uncomfortable experiences. So, yeah, I think the hype around psychedelics is warranted and good. But it needs to be done in the right way, in the right setting, so that we can actually have long lasting benefits and actually make the most of the potential of this stuff. And I'm sort of having some similar conversations around breathwork at the moment, because the rise in popularity of breathwork, it can come with ill intentions from some areas. And I think we have to be very careful when it comes to this kind of powerful work.
Yeah. And I think it is one of those things where, you know, anything that's going to work is going to create some controversy, right? If it did nothing, you know, people will go, oh, well, you know, whatever. But the professions are very threatened by things they don't know anything about, right? So if all of a sudden breath work has got, you know, a 30, for sake of argument, 30% healing in depression, and antidepressants have like a 20%. The physicians, the medical doctors are going to be like, well, I don't know about this stuff. It seems pretty weirdo to me. You know, they're not going to kind of jump on board because they don't like having that's going to help that they don't know anything about. Right. They are like, they're specialists, they're psychiatrists. Like, I know about the mind. I've studied it for 10 years or whatever. And here's something that comes along that they don't know anything about that appears to be very effective for some people. Right. And so that threatens them a lot. So I think we have to really kind of bring the medical profession along with us and trying to say, hey, and I think that's coming with psychedelics now, because they are seeing that it's helpful. They are seeing that it's working. So now you're getting a lot more psychiatrists volunteering for, like, okay, ketamine assisted psychotherapy, that kind of thing, you know, MDMA for PTSD seems to be very effective. So it is, you know, it's changing, but you don't see a lot of change in psychiatry. I mean, in the last 50 years, nothing has really significantly changed. And if you do believe you're a psychiatrist and you do believe it has, please, like, send me a message, because I would love to know what's changed, because nothing has really changed. I was trained in the, you know, risperidone, trazodone, antidepressant. I was trained in all that stuff. You know, I don't have the experience the psychiatrists do, of course, but, you know, I know about all those medications and I know their side effects and I know their limitations. And, you know, I the other thing I read in this book, and I know I'm rambling right now, but I want to make this one point, is that in this Peter Levine's book, in 1994, I think he said 44%, this is it, 44% of office-based psychiatrists in the U.S. did psychotherapy. in 10 years later, only 29%, and that would have been like 2005, only 29% were doing office-based psychotherapy in favor of adjusting medications for people. And I'm sure it's lower than that now. I'm sure it's probably in the, you know, the low 20s now, because it's a very pharmaceutically based model, and antidepressants have never cured anyone. They've helped with symptoms, but they've never, you know, in the 40 million people that have taken antidepressants, no one's been cured by them.
Yeah.
40 million, right?
Yeah.
Anyway,
I think that's part two of the episode that we could probably another discussion around.
And I'm not shaming people for taking, if you need medication, by all means, take it. Like, I'm not medication shaming. I'm just saying that it's really overprescribed.
Yeah, I agree. My first experience of that was at 17, where I was, in hindsight, dealing with depression and got taken to the GP, and was in and out in 5 minutes with a prescription for an SSRI. And I didn't end up taking them because I didn't want to, but also it was just baffling looking back, knowing what I know now, how quickly it was done for a 17-year-old kid who had clearly experienced, you know, this traumatic event of my parents splitting up. And there were no questions asked around, you know, what's happened. It's like, here you go, here's your prescription. That being said, 2-3 years ago, I actually did end up taking some SSRIs, antidepressants. So I'm very much kind of the same belief as you. They have their place. For me, the way my therapist described it to me was it would give me I would be able to keep my head above water long enough to be able to start addressing some of the root causes. So it was sort of helping with the symptoms, helping with the depth of the symptoms. I'm not a huge advocate, not a huge anti medication person either.
I got to jump in there because one of the things was, you know, that I really didn't like about antidepressants was people would come in and they had, you know, issues, you know, they had relationship issues, they had issues with their kids, all that kind of stuff. And you get put on an antidepressant and then they're like, okay, well, I don't want to deal with this stuff. Like so it would make them feel better so that they don't want to deal, like when they're feeling terrible, it's like, well, I got to deal with this shit. And then, but when they start feeling better, it's like, nah, it's too painful. Like the ego is like, we're not going in there. So I had people on who were taking antidepressants for like 10, 20, 25 years because, you know, it kind of, they weren't feeling happy or particularly sad. They weren't feeling much of anything, but they weren't feeling depressed or anxious anymore, but they weren't feeling much of anything. Yeah. And they just didn't want to go back into that old trauma. And for some people, you know, fair enough. Some traumas are pretty horrible. So, but that's, you know, my problem wasn't so much with antidepressants when they didn't work, it's when they did.
Yeah.
Because people would just stop, you know, doing therapy, a lot of them.
Yeah, you just sort of stop trying, I guess. It's that numbing effect that you've described. Yeah. It's like it sort of puts you into that state where, you know, you don't feel the big lows, but you also don't feel the big highs. And so you don't really have to dig into what might be causing it. And yeah, that's, you know, I'm very familiar with Bessel van der Kolk's work, Body Keeps the Score. And also there's a book that I'm waiting to read. It's on my shelf somewhere. The new Oprah Winfrey one with Dr. Bruce Perry. And it's all around trauma. It's called What Happened to You. And I think that for me is like, that's been a big part of what I've been talking about, is like shifting the question from what's wrong with you to what happened to you. And I think, you know, if I think back to my 17-year-old self in the doctor's office, if they'd asked, you know, what's happened, would have been a very, very different story to you know, what's wrong? What's up? Like, here's a medication to put a plaster over that, rather than addressing what's actually causing it.
Well, most doctors aren't trained in therapy. Like, they're not. Mm. And most doctors don't have time for therapy. Most doctors want to help. So their version of helping is to give you an antidepressant. So it's the model in which we're trained. And it also, there's no faster way of ending a interview with a patient than handing them a prescription. So like, they are trying to do it to help, but they don't have anything else. They don't have anything in their back pocket. They don't have somatic therapy. They don't have, you know, yoga, meditation, whatever. I mean, they can recommend it, but that's rare too, you know? So they don't have the time. they don't have the training, but they do want to help. So what happens is you wind up getting a medication. That's just how it works.
Do you, just before we wrap up, I guess my lofty goal through the work that I do, you know, with these conversations, with breath work, is like, I have a vision of a much more holistic approach to all of this, where, you know, there are solutions from somatic experiencing, breath work, where we're actually sort of digging into what the root cause is and then suggesting the best possible treatment. Like, it, do you think that is actually a realistic possibility given the way the medical system is currently set up?
Yeah, you know, we've tried that. You know, I live on the west coast of Canada, you know, and sort of the west coast of the States, and we're kind of like the, you know, the holistic, like let's have a chiropractor and a naturopath and a doctor and a surgeon in the same office. And it never works. It never works. But it's just, I mean, the ideologies are so different, you know. Yeah. That's the thing. And medicine is still, allopathic medicine is still held as kind of like the gold standard up which everything else is compared to, which is good and bad in a way. It's good in that it prevents a lot of, you know, charlatans taking advantage of people's, you know, so you're take this poot nut oil and it'll cure your, you know, STD or whatever. But, you know, the downside of that is that they're very rigid, you know, they're not really open. And the thing about that is the new things that actually do work aren't really, it takes a long time for them to become accepted and mainstream. So it's a double-edged sword for sure. I think we need doctors. I love doctors. I think medical doctors are amazing for the most part. But we do need that kind of standard to compare everything else against. The problem with that is the holier-than-thou attitude that medical doctors have. And I am one, so it's like I can speak from the group. And that we just sort of shut out things that we don't understand. But there are a lot of people out there who take advantage of people with things that really don't have any benefit. So that's kind of our role in a way. So that's, you know, don't go looking for innovation at the medical doctors because you're not going to get it. But that's part of our role, is just to be this consistent kind of grandfatherly, predictable kind of pharmaceutically based profession that we are. And that's just how it is. You know, so, you know, don't go to a GP thinking that you're going to get therapy, because, you know, it's like going to the hardware store looking for peanut butter. You're not going to find it there. And if you do find it there, it's probably not going to be that great of a peanut butter.
Yeah, it's sort of, it looks kind of the same. It's in a building next door, but it's like a peanut butter that you've never heard of before. And it tastes a little bit funky. I think it's probably a fair analogy. Yeah.
But I'd love it if we could find a way of doing that. It's just that it's been tried for so many years and no one's really been able to do it. I think it's just because the philosophies are. And the other thing is, I think that medical doctors have been really hard on chiropractors, naturopaths, you know, the alternative practitioners. So, you know, why would they want to go and work with someone who just doesn't have any confidence in them? So that's another, you know, that's another reason too. So
yeah, definitely, definitely. And to close, there's one question, I guess, I'd like to try and leave people with something practical as well as, you know, incredibly insightful. If you were to give, and this might be a tricky question, but I'm hoping you have an answer, sort of one tip to anyone who is experiencing anxiety in their life, which is probably most people, let's put it simply, what would your tip be? What would your advice be?
Just to redirect your energy into your body, you know, finding the alarm in your body, putting your hand over it, connecting with it, breathing into it, finding, even if you have to breathe in the pain, like even when things really feel painful, even breathing in the pain, like it's like a Tonglen exercise, you know, Pema Chodron talks about that too. And just, it does make sense because you are hurting, like it does hurt. And if you sort of breathe in the pain and just accept that there's a sense that you have some sort of control or agency over it. So it's just, and Bessel van der Kolk talks about, you know, we're not getting rid of people's anxiety. What we're really doing is getting them to acclimatize to the negative nature of it and not make a huge story out of it. So just when you're in anxiety, when you're overthinking, it's just try to find a way to get into the sensation of your body, essential oil, touch, breath, you know, all this kind of stuff to get into your body. Because as soon as you devote a lot of your energy into your body, it's much less energy left over to keep focusing on those negative thoughts of the mind. So just get out of your head and into your body is probably the shortest way I could say that.
Yeah, it's a phrase I come back to a lot in my own teaching. So I think that's a perfect place to finish. Russ, thank you so much for your time, for joining me.
Thanks for keeping breath work up there. I think it's just so important that people have. I recommend you every. I do a club room on Clubhouse every Sunday at noon and 8 p.m. in the UK, I guess it is. And every week I talk about breathwork. Every week I say that it's, you know, go to Clubhouse, go to Jamie Clements breathwork, you know, like work through this stuff. And it's really, really important to keep going on it because it can keep you off of medication. You know, it is one of those things that can really help you. So just, you know, just be aware that there are other options out there.
Definitely. And my last question, and then I'll let you go. If people do want to find out more from you, more about you, where are the best places to find you?
Usually if you Google the Anxiety MD, like the Anxiety MD is my, my YouTube, it's my Instagram, it's my website. So just the Anxiety MD. And that's the easiest way to find me. And just, if you Google that, a bunch of my stuff will come up and it's easy to find me. And I have hypno meditations on my website. I have a link to my book. Please consider getting my book if you struggle with anxiety. It's different than any other book. I do have also a podcast. It's also called Anxiety RX, which is the same as the book. And I put chapters of the book on that podcast so that you can really get an idea of my philosophy as to what anxiety is and what it isn't, and sort of the non-traditional kind of counterintuitive way that I have of treating it, because that's the only way that healed me.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I would encourage everybody to get stuck into some of Russ's content, the book, the podcast, all of it, because yeah, it will help you. I'll put my hat on that. It will help you. Russ, thank you for being here. And again, thank you for your time.
Anytime, man.
So that is it for today's episode of Man Down. Thank you so much for tuning in. As always, tune in every Sunday for the next episode of Man Down with our next inspirational guest. If you want to get in touch, or if there's anyone that you think should be on the podcast, you can reach out directly on Instagram at jamie.clements_ or by email on jamie@mandownpod.co.uk.